Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. What does it take to create a healthy community? Vaccines to protect against diseases are one piece of the public health puzzle. A revamped CDC advisory panel, handpicked by Health and Human Services Secretary Robert Kennedy Jr., is making its recommendations this week on some key vaccines. The new group includes some prominent vaccine skeptics, raising concerns about the direction of this influential panel. Lauren Gardner is a health reporter for Politico, who's been following the developments of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. Welcome to All Sides, Lauren.
Thanks for having me.
So the panel, I just called it the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, but for more simple purposes, do they call themselves ACIP? Is that right?
Yeah, ACIP or ACIP.
Okay. We'll go with ACIP right now. It sounds catchy. So yeah. Before we jump into the latest news, let's catch up listeners on the background of ACIP, this panel. What is its role traditionally as an advisory panel?
Yeah, so ACIP dates back to 1964, and this is a group of independent vaccine experts. So these aren't federal employees. They usually represent a cross section of, you know, infectious disease experts, pediatricians, very specific vaccinologists, people who work in public health. And it's a group that's brought together under the auspices of the CDC, and they typically meet three times a year to go over data that's been collected about different vaccine products in terms of safety and efficacy. And then they also review new products that have been approved by the FDA and debate and discuss the science around those, and then make recommendations about how those products should be used in the broader population. So while the FDA approves a specific medical intervention for safety and efficacy, this group that advises the CDC talks about how exactly that should be, you know, used in the wider population. So they look at it through the public health lens.
Now, earlier in June, Secretary Kennedy abruptly fired 17 members of the committee. They were independent vaccine experts, as you said. But was this a first for the committee? Had people been removed or from it before?
Yeah, this was really unprecedented. Members of ACIP are very thoroughly vetted for conflicts of interest. You'll hear from people who subscribe to Secretary Kennedy's vaccine skepticism that there have been controversies in the past, and there have been some federal reports about how well that conflicts of interest process was kind of guided in the past. But anyone that is in the public health space that I've talked to about this say, you know, this is a completely, you know, if not outdated, just wrong take on how this panel works. I mean, these people have to go through a very thorough financial vetting. They have to disclose any possible conflict that could arise. So any stocks they own, any work that they've done for a pharmaceutical company, any patents they own, all of that has to be disclosed and combed through by ethics experts in the federal government. And some past members have said that this process can take up to 2 years. So this raises a lot of questions about how thoroughly the current members who are sitting in Atlanta or are dialing into Atlanta right now were assessed.
Columbus Public Health Commissioner Dr. Mashika Roberts is one of those who went through the combing process. She was supposed to be on the panel, and her position was terminated. Her term was to begin in July. She was scheduled to join us on the show today, but had a last-minute emergency that forced her to cancel. But the day after she received that termination email, she sat down with a local TV station here, Channel 10's Tracy Townsend, to discuss her reaction.
And so with the new administration coming in, I was always a little pessimistic about what would really happen. And so I can't say I'm really surprised, but I'm definitely disappointed, and I'm concerned about the guidance that we'll get from a public health perspective on immunizations moving forward with this administration.
So Secretary Kennedy terminated the entire panel, as you said. Were you familiar with Dr. Roberts being on the panel, or was it, what kinds of conflicts do you think might be involved if they weren't vetted for 2 years like others were?
You mean for the new panel?
Yeah.
So one of the members of the new panel, Dr. Cody Meissner, he has served on ACIP before. He most recently was on the FDA's own independent vaccine panel. They've got another fun acronym that I won't get into. So he has a record of, you know, past affiliations with different pharma companies that he's openly disclosed. You can search that on the CDC's website. You know, one thing that HHS has done under Secretary Kennedy has made searching those past declarations of conflicts kind of, you know, easier to find. Mm-hmm. And one past member who I talked to said, hey, that's a good thing. You know, makes it, this was already in the public domain, but it makes it easier to find. But it also kind of just reinforces the point that these members have always had to state when they've had these, anything that could even seem like a conflict. So he's currently serving and he's disclosed various things before, you know, past business dealings. And then even this morning, Vicky Pebsworth is, she's a new member of ACIP and has served on the board of the National Vaccine Information Center, which despite its name is actually very well known for being an anti-vaccine group. She said herself, I don't know if I have any conflicts, but I'm going to read this statement about different financial holdings that I have that may or may not look a certain way. Hmm. So that's where we are.
And Dr. Roberts also said in her interview on Channel 10, she touched on what would happen if the committee decides not to recommend certain vaccines.
That could mean vaccines that we've been getting for a long time and have been keeping us healthy and safe could no longer be covered on your insurance and you'd have to pay out of pocket for the vaccine. And, I just want to remind people, like, you know, we've seen these outbreaks of measles, we've seen pertussis, but, you know, if you go back 100 years, those were the diseases that were killing our communities. And with the advent of antibiotics and vaccines, we've seen a reduction in infectious disease deaths as well as infectious disease hospitalizations.
Now, is that true? This committee carries a lot of weight with not just what happens, but also with insurance companies. Whether an insurance company will cover a vaccine or not depends on what this panel says.
Absolutely. So ACIP really has like a two-pronged influence here. One, just the recommendations, like we've talked about, the influence over what pediatrician practices and family doctors recommend to their patients. And then the second is this insurance tie. So while ACIP wasn't necessarily like directed by Congress to exist, its function has been written into various parts of federal law to the point where under the Affordable Care Act, for example, any vaccine that is recommended by ACIP is required under most health insurance plans to be provided at no cost mm-hmm. to people. So, you know, we all have gone through the pandemic experience of having COVID vaccines, you know, free and at the ready to be able to get, but that also applies to, say, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine that children are recommended to get twice in childhood, the flu vaccine, hepatitis B. All of these shots that we kind of take for granted as having always been widely available and recommended for use, they're generally supposed to be provided at no cost to people. And these individual shots can cost, you know, anywhere from over $50 per shot to, you know, closer to $200, depending on how new a product might be. So when you add it all up together, it can cost a lot of money to a family that, you know, may not have the luxury of being able to squirrel away to take care of those bills.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the latest news with the CDC Vaccine Advisory Panel, which is meeting today. With us, we have Lauren Gardner, a health reporter for Politico. So can you catch us up on what the advisory panel has recommended so far during their meeting? The meeting began yesterday, and this morning, I understand, a vote happened on RSV, which is a vaccine for infants. RSV is a disease that impacts infants and elderly people more than any other. Can you tell me about that vote today?
Yes. So this morning, the panel did vote 5-2. To recommend a new product. It's actually, while it's being considered by the vaccine committee, it is a shot. It's actually a monoclonal antibody, which means that it delivers passive immunity to infants. So instead of kind of gearing up your immune system to produce your own antibodies to fight off an infection, it just delivers those antibodies straight into the body. So it's scientifically different, but you know it gives off kind of this it's in a similar family, let's say, to vaccines. So they did vote to approve it today. There is already one of these products on the market. This is a second option, so it creates a level of competition now. It was recommended for infants 8 months under 8 months of age, and but this happened after a pretty extensive debate about the safety of this product, and it there was actually a lot of pushback by Dr. Meissner, the member I mentioned before, who was previously served on this panel, you know, talking about the safety of this, and also just the fact that RSV can be very, very serious and severe in infants who were otherwise healthy. There were a lot of questions about whether this is something that should be used by parents of, you know, quote unquote healthy children, those who were born who weren't premature, who don't have underlying, you know, congenital issues. But you know, I can attest personally, my child had RSV when she was a young baby, and it was not fun. We ended up going to the hospital. So it can impact anyone. And I believe the statistic Dr. Meissner said was, you know, about 80% of hospitalized infants for RSV are those otherwise healthy babies. So you can't really predict who might end up in the hospital versus who just ends up staying home from daycare with a bad cold.
Now, it was kind of a surprise that they did recommend the RSV vaccine, only because they had also previously, earlier in the day yesterday, said that they were going to take all childhood vaccines under advisement. They're going to look into it all, right? So, what does that mean if they're going to just take a look at what's happening with childhood vaccines?
Yeah, so yesterday, the chair of the group announced that they're going to form a working group to investigate the childhood vaccine schedule. And the impetus for this, if you follow the anti-vaccine movement closely, is their argument is that the schedule has exploded since the late 1980s. You know, kids used to get X number of shots, and now that's like exponentially increased, and there's been an increase over the same amount of time in chronic disease in Americans, and in particularly young Americans, and they claim that this is linked. You talk to any public health expert who studies vaccines closely, and they fervently deny this. You know, all vaccines are examined for safety and efficacy before they are approved. And while you know, I've talked to some in the public health community who say, you know, we should be open to, you know, talking about concerns about safety and the added benefit of all of these vaccines, but at the same time, there should be a scientific underpinning for any discussion along those lines. And the concern raised by groups like the American Academy of Pediatrics is that there has been nothing to suggest that the childhood vaccine schedule is unsafe in any way for the American public.
Now, obviously, this working group will take a little time to look at the childhood vaccine, so we won't know the results of that during this set of meetings that they have, but they are meeting all day today. What else are we expecting out of this set of meetings for this advisory panel?
Yeah, so later today, they're going to take a vote on recommendations for the flu vaccine for the next respiratory virus season. So that's, you know, beginning in August and September when you typically go to your pharmacy down the street and get a flu shot. They're going to make recommendations for who should get that. Historically, in the past, it's been anyone 6 months and older is recommended to get a flu shot in the United States. So we'll see how that goes today. And then there is also scheduled to be a vote on the use of thimerosal in flu vaccines, which was an eyebrow-raising add to the agenda when it came out within the last week.
So you're going to have to tell me what thimerosal is.
Yeah, I knew I was going to. So
Yeah.
thimerosal is a preservative that has historically been used in multi-dose vials of vaccines, and in particular flu vaccines. It's put there because at any time you stab a vial with a syringe, it you know can create it can increase the risk of introducing pathogens into that vial. So that's put in there to inhibit the growth of bacteria, et cetera. Multi-dose vials of flu vaccine are not widely used in the United States anymore. The latest statistics from the CDC are that 96% of flu vaccines that were available, that were administered in the US last year, were thimerosal free. And then also putting that aside, there has been ample scientific study of concerns about thimerosal. In particular, anti-vaccine groups have suggested that it's linked to autism. And that has been debunked by a plethora of scientific studies. They found no link between the use of this preservative and the development of autism. The preservative itself, it's a mercury containing compound. So when you hear people talk about mercury and vaccines, this is what they're referring to. One person in particular that I've followed, likened it to say, you know, sodium is good for people. Put a little sodium or put a little table salt in your glass of water if you've been sweating to replenish your electrolytes. That's good for you. Putting half a cup of salt into your glass of water, that's dangerous to you. So the way this metabolizes in the body is completely different from mercury that we fear from, say, fish. It works totally differently. So it is not an apples to oranges comparison. And back to what I was saying in the beginning, it is not used very much in flu vaccines anymore. It also wasn't used in many of the childhood vaccines that have been around for decades that these groups are also wary of, like say the MMR vaccine. It was never used in those.
So, I mean, if we get rid of it, it wouldn't have that much of an impact here in the United States if it's not used that much.
On the surface, yes. Though someone at the AAP who I talked to yesterday made the point that, you know, you're looking at this on a population scale, right? So the goal is to get as many Americans as possible vaccinated against flu every year. So even if only 4% of the supply is implicated in terms of having thimerosal as an ingredient, small percentages matter. Because there is still someone out there who, you know, say if that's the type of vaccine that's available at a state or local health department clinic, and that's what they've been able to procure. If anything is suggested from ACIP that, you know, this isn't something that most people should get, that can create an access problem for that population that, you know, maybe they don't have a lot of pharmacies in their in the area in which they live. Maybe they live in a rural area and they rely on vaccine drives put on by their state or local health department to be able to get that protection every year. So that's where the concern comes in.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. We've run out of time. We've been talking with Lauren Gardner, a health reporter for Politico. Thank you so much for joining us today, Lauren.
Thanks again.
And coming up, we're going to talk about the overall health of Central Ohioans and how an updated health map sets priorities for doctors, hospitals, and the community. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Business can become a WOSU underwriter. Our listeners say they prefer to do business with organizations that support public media. Like you, our listeners strive to make a difference in their communities through activism, education, and supportive charitable organizations. You can reach these loyal listeners with your messaging when your business supports WOSU programs as an underwriter. For more information, visit WOSU.org/support.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. How do health officials figure out what ails a community and how to fix it? In Franklin County, they've made periodic updates to what is known as a health map. It identifies critical issues like mental health, infant mortality, childhood trauma, and even a lack of adequate housing, and the impact of all that on overall health. This time around the Health Map 2025, they invited more people into the process to come up with the latest roadmap for better health outcomes. Joining us now to talk about it is Dr. Andrew Thomas, Chief Clinical Officer for Ohio State's Wexner Medical Center. He's also the Senior Associate Vice President of Health Services. Welcome to All Sides, Dr. Thomas.
Thanks so much for having me, Amy.
We're interested in knowing more about the Health Map 2025. The subtitle of the map is Navigating Our Way to a Healthier Community Together. So I'm guessing a key word there is together. The process for this year's map involved more players than in the past. Who did you add into the group to help shape the map and its priorities?
You're exactly right, Amy. First of all, I'd like to make clear, even though obviously you read my title as OSU Wexner Medical Center, I'm really here representing all four health systems in the city. And this has been a great partnership between Nationwide Children's, Mount Carmel Health System, and Ohio Health and Ohio State since the community health needs assessment process started after the Affordable Care Act. Since 2013, this is now our fifth health map, and we've agreed as the four health systems in the community that we would partner together on doing this work. Every hospital in the country is required to do a community health needs assessment every 3 years, but we've done it jointly for a few reasons. First of all, we have to go out and gather data in the community. And if all four organizations were calling the same people to get the same data, it just didn't make sense from an efficiency perspective. But what it's allowed us to do is create a platform and a shared understanding that we each then layer our own individual plans on top of the health map data. But your point about the togetherness, the last two, both the one in 2022 and the one this year, we've not just engaged the four health systems and the Central Ohio Hospital Council, we've engaged both the city and the county health departments, as well as over 25 social service agencies, nonprofits, other people that have a similar focus on the health of the community. And we believe it's a national model for how cities like Columbus and counties like Franklin County can do this work together, not just the health systems partnering together, but public health and the social service agencies.
Now, you mentioned a lot of health systems there working on this plan, but I think that a lot of people know, pardon the pun, but there's a healthy competition between hospitals. You know, there's a level of competition, but you're turning more toward cooperation and collaboration. How do you solve that balance there between hospitals do compete against each other for funding, for resources, for who's best at what? How do you balance that versus creating this map together?
Well, a couple of different ways. I think you're exactly right that there's a healthy competition in the city. I will say when I talk to colleagues in Chicago or Boston or Houston, health systems in their communities can't even talk to each other. The CEOs can't even be in the same room. There's so much animus between. That's just not something we've done here in Columbus. And I think over the last 20 years that I've been in a leadership role, I think the pandemic was a great example of how we all tried to partner together to make sure we had a shared sense of guidelines and policies and processes. So you didn't get a significantly different experience at Mount Carmel or Ohio Health than you did at Ohio State. There have been different times when we've really needed the IV fluid shortage, for example, that happened last fall, where we've all partnered together. But I think on some of these issues, Ohio Better Birth Outcomes is actually a partnership of the four health systems and the health departments and a number of the federally qualified health centers in town that grew out of the Greater Columbus Infant Mortality Task Force and Celebrate One. So it was a way that on an issue of maternal and infant health, we've been partnering together for, almost 13 years, trying to tackle these things. A lot of that work happens behind the scenes, I get that, but that partnership is there. We have a monthly call where all the medical leaders of the four health systems and the two health departments all talk together each month, separate from the health map.
I identified, you know, there's a lot of issues looked at as critical issues: mental health, infant mortality, childhood trauma, lack of housing. Do you have a favorite key priority coming out of this health map?
Well, I think if you compare this year's health map with previous versions, the one that I think sticks out the most to me is the adverse childhood experiences. Mm. It's a newly higher focus in this health map. And I think it certainly recognizes that adverse life experiences for kids are things that create risk of post-traumatic stress disorder. They create either thinking patterns or behavior patterns that then can impact that child for 30, 40, 50, 60 years when you look out at the health of the community two generations from now. So I think the focus on both trying to reduce the risk of adverse childhood experience or the rate of adverse childhood experiences, but then doing a better job of building services around those individuals so that they are not at risk in their 20s, 30s, and 40s of having either substance issues, behavioral health problems, inability to form relationships and have jobs and contribute to the community. In my mind, of the elements of the health map, all of them are important. But that's one I think that the focus on that in this year's health map really stands out as a new item and a great approach as we partner across the city on these issues.
That's very interesting. I mean, I could come up with a laundry list of things that would be an adverse childhood experience, but how do you solve them? I mean, that just seems like quite the large problem.
Well, it is. And that's actually back to the togetherness, partly why the four health systems really wanted to get beyond our four organizations in managing these things, whether it's the local school systems, whether it's Franklin County Children's Services. You know, this is not something that just happens at your hospital or even in your doctor's office. These mm-hmm. are things that are social issues across our communities. But to your point, a lot of these things are also intertwined. You can imagine if you are a three-year-old and you have a younger sibling who passes away under age one, right? That's a traumatic experience in your home, for your parents, for you. If think under violence and injury-related deaths. If you have an older sibling who's a teenager who is a victim of gun violence, or you have a parent that overdoses on narcotics, that's an, so if we, these things are all really interrelated. Some of that, how do you prevent them, is we fix the other four things, right? Mm-hmm. That are the five priority areas. But also when they do occur, we want that rate to be lower, but it's how do we then wrap services around the child? Some of that's at Nationwide Children. Some of that might be in the school system. Some of that may be in their church or place of worship, to make sure that because to your point, everyone has things that happen in their life that are stressful and traumatic. We want to reduce the risk of those and the rate of those. But when they do happen, how do we respond as a community and make sure that those programs are in place to help those young people process that and move forward in their life?
This is All Signs on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with Dr. Andrew Thomas with Ohio State's Wexner Medical Center, but he's also representing many other health systems, and he is working on the Health Map 2025. I wanted to get your take on something we talked about earlier in the show, because it's in the news right now. It's the role immunizations play in creating and maintaining a healthy community. I wanted to get your take on the vaccine panel that's meeting right now, the new CDC advisory panel. They're having a meeting now. They're making a lot of recommendations. There are some vaccine skeptics on the new 7-member panel. How do you take conflicting guidance if local healthcare professionals on a local level here believe one thing, but the federal government is saying another thing? How do you balance that?
Well, a couple of things. First, I would say we were very proud that Dr. Mashika Roberts, health commissioner in the city of Columbus, had been added mm-hmm. to that panel before these changes in membership were made. She's just a huge asset to our community, and I think would have been an excellent member of that panel. That being said, I think, and I'm certainly not a pediatrician. I know a lot of the focus has been around the childhood vaccines, and I'm not a vaccine expert, but from my vantage point as a physician, I counsel my patients about vaccines, just like I would counsel my patients about any other medicine. So when any medicine gets through the FDA approval process, there has to be a benefit to those medicines, but all of them have side effect profiles and risks. So there's no medical intervention, procedure, test, medication or vaccine that's not going to have some risk of a side effect or some risk of a problem for the patient. That being said, these are tested rigorously to make sure that the benefit that's there, both for the individual as well as society, is more value than the small risk that would come along. Sometimes those risks are a little low-grade fever or aches and pains, but there are times when patients do have bad reactions to vaccines in the moment. But those are very exceedingly rare compared to widespread measles or mumps or chickenpox in the community, or the risk of spreading hepatitis easily amongst individuals. So preventing that risk is incredibly important. I'm hopeful that at the end of the day, the new panel will see through the science of how they've been tested and the rigor they've been tested with to continue to have vaccines on the market. I think the devil's going to be a little in the details about whether something is recommended for everyone or recommended with some caveats of age or caveats of medical conditions you have. Those are kind of routine things that we track the science on with vaccines all the time. So I think that the details of what they come out with are going to be very important to follow.
You served on Governor DeWine's health advisory group and provided guidance during COVID-19. So what's your reaction to some of the new recommendations about COVID-19? That's what they changed some of the recommendations for age and related to pregnant women. How would you counsel people related to COVID-19 vaccines right now?
Well, I counsel my patients related to this. I think that taking into account someone's health status, if they have diabetes, if they're in the middle of cancer treatment, if they've had an organ transplant, and certainly age, because the as we saw throughout the pandemic, if you were older and you had more health issues when you met COVID for the first time, that determined how sick you got. So I do think the average 25-year-old tolerates it just fine. Now that there is a different level of immunity in the community because a lot of people have had COVID, I do think that the risk to younger people is a lot lower. So I think there may be some validity, and because we're at a very different point than we were in December of 2020 when the vaccines first came out, in terms of trying to get immunity spread quickly through the community so that those 65 or 75 year old people who hadn't been vaccinated yet were less likely to run into a 30-year-old who was coughing COVID on them.
Yeah.
Right. We're in a much different state now than it was. And I think that that's a rational approach to take it, to stratify based on age and health risks.
Okay. Well, the last question I promise I'll ask you about COVID-19 is related to pregnant women, because I think a lot of people can understand what you said about age in a healthy 25-year-old, even healthy children. But there's a lot of people who are feeling confused about the recommendation that pregnant women not take the vaccine.
Yeah, I've not looked at the most recent data on that, and I'm not sure exactly what data the panel used to determine that. All I can tell you is that we did have a number of times during the pandemic where we had young, otherwise healthy people that were pregnant that ended up in extreme illness. I think that in general, when people are pregnant, that's two people's health that we're dealing with, not just one, or maybe more than two if they have pregnant with more than one child. I've not looked at that data, so I probably can't comment specifically on pregnant women, but they're definitely a higher risk population.
And I would just, in the couple minutes we have left of your time, I wanted to get back to the health map a little bit. You mentioned, you know, one of the key points to you, one of the priorities is the adverse childhood experiences. But there's also a big section where you're talking about mental health. The first mental health crisis care center is opening, or maybe it has opened already. And it's expected to take, or the goal is to take burden off of hospital ERs. Can you tell me more about that?
I sure can. This has been a great community effort now, going back the idea more than a decade, but certainly in the development of the idea, 5 to 6 years in construction building. Erica Clark-Jones and her team at the Franklin County Adam H. Board have done an amazing job of partnering city government, county government, state government. I believe there's also maybe some federal money in the project as well. But each of the health systems, the adult health systems invested in that work and to share funds to help bring this to light. It did have its ribbon cutting in May. It's going to open over the course of the next 9 months, because there are multiple different levels of service in the building. But you're correct that what this is, that the ER, when someone is an extremist in terms of risk of suicide or risk of hurting themselves, we want them in a safe place. And for years in our community, the ER might have been the best way to get them into a safe place, but it's not a great place for their assessment and their treatment. ERs are busy places, their lab, they're the exact opposite of where you'd want to put someone in a mental health crisis. So we're thrilled that this is designed from the bottom up to be patient-centered for this specific patient population. The resources that will be at that facility are going to be outstanding. And we often say in medicine that part of our job is to meet people on the worst day of their life. And I think when you add in someone in behavioral health crisis, that fits that bill quite a lot of the time. And this is a center designed just for those patients. And I do think if you look at all of the ERs in the city, we've been that safe haven for either EMS or police or family members to bring a patient who was at risk. That in some ways impacts our ability to serve other patients in our ERs that have traumas or strokes or heart attacks. So this is going to offload those patients, but it's not about offloading patients. It's about making sure they're actually in the best place to get the care that they need.
And the last question I'll ask you about the health map is it uses zip code information to provide like a health snapshot neighborhood by neighborhood. How is that used at a hospital level? Is that valuable to a hospital to know more about zip codes?
It certainly is. I think I believe you've had Dr. Roberts on before talking about redlining and other things in the history of not just Columbus, but cities across the country. And when you look at certain zip codes where two zip codes away, the life expectancies a decade or longer, I mean, obviously those zip codes are artificial lines, but at the same time, they do show you that risks in different parts of our community. And some of those are driven by income. Some of those are driven by other services available in different zip codes. But I think as a medical center, when we go out and figure out where do we want to put one of our primary care offices, or where do we want to put our healthy community center, where do we want to focus our next site for our federally qualified health center, we certainly use that data to determine where the neighborhoods are that are most in need. I think Celebrate One has used that data very effectively to try and target efforts around infant mortality in specific neighborhoods related to everything from grocery stores to churches to barbershops in terms of how they've tried to share information. But using that as a way to specifically target interventions in the places that need them the most.
We've been talking with Dr. Andrew Thomas, Chief Clinical Officer at Ohio State's Wexner Medical Center, and we've been talking about his work with other hospital communities in creating Health Map 2025. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Amy.
And coming up, we're going to hear another perspective on how to create a healthy community in Central Ohio. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
It's summer fun for everyone. Join WOSU at family community events and festivals all summer long. Have your picture taken with beloved PBS characters, do a craft, show your WOSU spirit, and win prizes. For all dates and locations, visit our events page, wosu.org/events. We can't wait to meet you.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and I'm Amy Jurevich. How do health officials figure out what ails a community and how to fix it? In Franklin County, they've made periodic updates to what is known as a health map. It identifies critical issues like mental health, infant mortality, childhood trauma, and even a lack of adequate housing, and that's overall impact on health. This time around, Health Map 2025, they invited more people into the process to come up with the latest roadmap toward better health outcomes. Joining us now is Franklin County Health Commissioner Joe Mazzola. Welcome to All Sides, Joe.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we heard a few minutes ago from Dr. Andy Thomas, who brought input from area hospitals into the health map process. But I wanted to get a sense from you from the Franklin County level as a whole. What do you think is the top priority identified in this health map?
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you to our hospital partners, the Central Hospital Council and Columbus Public Health, and all of our steering committee members who are part of Health Map 2025. It's been a very, such a grateful experience that we can work so collaboratively here in Franklin County. I think Dr. Thomas talked about that. It doesn't happen in every community. So, but to your question, it's not really what I think, it's really what we think. And so, you know, that's what makes this process so meaningful, is that when we gather the data between the two health departments and our hospital partners, and then we present those data to our steering committee members, we go through a very intentional process to facilitate what are those priorities for this community. It's not one person, it's not one organization, it's the collective. And so for us, it's, you know, as you mentioned, it's these new five priorities, which really came out through those conversations and through that dialogue with our steering committee members and the two health departments and our hospital partners.
Our previous guest mentioned that I made him pick a favorite health priority, which is like a weird thing to ask, but he mentioned the addition of adverse childhood experiences. Is that something that you haven't really, quote unquote, mapped before on your map?
It's not. And I would absolutely agree with Dr. Thomas on that. So at Franklin County Public Health, we've been really trying to raise awareness around the issue of adverse childhood experiences. We've hosted a summit in 2021 where we had 300 partners come together for one day. We did that again in 2023, and we're actually going to do that again next month. And so, but it's not just about that day. It's about how do we as a community become a ACEs resilient community. And so this new information that Health Map 2025 is giving us.
When you say ACE is resilient, that took me a second. So ACE, you're saying adverse childhood experiences.
Adverse childhood experiences or ACEs.
Yes. Okay.
We want to be an ACEs resilient community. And so now we have the data to help us inform those strategies moving forward.
Now, you cited affordable housing and safe housing as also a top health concern. As we all know, there is a shortage of affordable housing in Franklin County, especially within Columbus. So how do you look at this issue from a medical standpoint? Connect housing and medical conditions to me.
Sure. So, you know, and I'm not a housing expert, but I you know, what we have always seen from a public health standpoint is the relationship between safe and affordable housing and how that impacts health. And that could be a whole host of different things. And, you know, the continuum of housing, we know we have challenges from emergency housing, transitional housing, and then safe, affordable housing as well. But when you think about individuals who are housing insecure, that means a whole lot of things. That means they're not able to potentially afford access to healthy foods. That means they may be economically insecure. That could be any host of things in terms of other barriers and challenges. And it really starts with that housing component. If you don't have a safe house to go to every day and your family is not that doesn't have that safe environment, we know it just translates to so many other public health concerns. And so for us, again, for the steering committee, it was something that sort of rose to the top. We do have a kind of a framework that we've been using for the last couple of years regarding social determinants of health, and housing is one of those pillars, if you will. Mm-hmm. But now that we have this new health assessment, we have identified housing as kind of that critical component to really emphasize as we think about all of those social determinants of health, and they all are connected, but it really does start with housing.
How do we build houses faster then? I know you just said you're not a housing expert, you're the health guy, but man, it takes a while to build a house. You can't just pop it up overnight.
That's correct. And no, I am not a housing expert, but I want to say this very clearly. I am so grateful for those organizations that are leading efforts to address the housing crisis in our community. They're doing incredible work and doing work that is very difficult, and it takes time. And so from a public health standpoint, we stand with them, we're supporting them, and we're engaging with them as they're doing their planning, and they're actually engaging with us as we're doing ours. And so that, I think, is what makes this work, is that, you know, we have organizations that are housing experts or connect with housing experts, and they're part of those conversations with us. And when they're doing their planning, we want to be a part of those conversations so we can understand why is it that we're experiencing some of the housing challenges in our community, so that we can think through from a public health standpoint, how can we support those families and those individuals who are affected by it?
In the report, you also talk about access to healthy food, grocery store deserts that we have around Franklin County, the rising cost of food. What steps are being taken to solve this problem?
Well, a lot of steps that we probably don't have a whole bunch of time to talk about here today. And I want to give credit to those organizations that are in that work every day, like the Mid-Ohio Food Collective, our hospitals, our community health centers, all of those organizations that are doing that cross-sector collaboration. Mm-hmm. It's not just about, you know, putting a new grocery store in a community. It's about how do we kind of build that out and connect those residents to other resources as well. And so when you have healthcare and nonprofits working together with local government, that's how all these things are successful. But we do know we have food insecurity issues in Franklin County. We also know that, you know, with state and federal legislation looming, that we potentially are going to see that exacerbate over the next couple of months. So we're kind of thinking about how do we, start to prepare for that. So, again, food insecurity is one of those issues that we're engaged with many partners to address that at the neighborhood level, as well as at the county level through collective impact work like the Local Food Action Plan and so forth, and working with our board of commissioners and other agencies to really address that collectively.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with Franklin County Health Commissioner Joe Mazzola about the 2025 health map. Earlier in the show, we talked about vaccines and changes that could be coming at the federal level as a vaccine advisory committee meets this week in terms of immunization recommendations. How do you reconcile the differences when guidance at a local level may differ from guidance at a federal level? I mean, how do you keep everyone's best interests at heart?
I heard the question that you asked for Dr. Thomas. And so, you know, that's actually something that we have not had to really struggle with from a public health standpoint, mm-hmm. something that we're going to have to work through, likely. At the end of the day, these are individual conversations between a resident and their healthcare provider. Mm-hmm. But also, we do want to speak with one voice from a public health standpoint. I think Dr. Thomas mentioned this. Dr. Mashika Roberts would have been a great participant on that committee. But where we are with this, with these new recommendations, we're going to be keeping a close eye on obviously what those recommendations look like. We want to make sure that the vaccines that we know are safe and effective continue to be made available to our community. And so, you know, we're going to take this one step at a time. We're not going to get ahead of any kind of recommendations or perhaps presumed recommendations. But, you know, from a public health standpoint, we are a bit concerned about that conflicting guidance. We know at the end of the day, residents want to trust those recommendations, and we want to trust those recommendations. So we'll be working with our state partners. We'll be looking at those federal recommendations. And then locally, you know, we will be speaking with one voice.
And we don't want to speculate on exactly what the panel will do because they're meeting right now. But they did take some action related to COVID vaccines and saying that they're not necessary for young people. So the idea of them making a recommendation about a COVID vaccine could mean that insurance companies will therefore not cover it. So if a healthy 20-year-old wants a COVID vaccine, his or her insurance might not cover it anymore. Is there a way Franklin County can step in there and help pay for these if people want them?
That's a great question, and that's something we're going to probably be asking once we sort of see that final guidance. Mm-hmm. And that is a concern because if it's not recommended, as you talked about earlier, it likely may not be covered by insurance. And mm-hmm. so from an access to care standpoint, we do have concerns for those individuals who are seeking vaccines and may not be able to access that from a financial standpoint. And so we'll be having a lot of conversations about that in the next couple months.
Well, that also could be a concern for people who don't have insurance,
correct.
Right? And we're getting the vaccines for
correct.
Free anyway by coming to, you know, the health department, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And you're going to just say, I don't know what's happening. You have to wait and see, right?
Well, I think it's a little early to get too mm-hmm. ahead of the conversation, but yeah. I would just stress that we are very, very concerned about it. And yeah. we're having some conversations about how do we plan to partner with our community health centers, our hospitals, our other providers, our pharmacies to make sure that we can do everything we can to make sure that we're providing those resources to our residents.
You were recently on a panel at the Columbus Metropolitan Club with Dr. Thomas and also with Columbus Public Health Commissioner Dr. Mashika Roberts, who you mentioned, mm-hmm. discussing the health map. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Roberts, in that discussion, identified infant mortality as one of her top priorities. She called it one of the most sensitive indicators of how healthy a community is. Can you talk about there is a big disparity in Ohio between blacks and whites when it comes to maternal health and infant mortality. How do you see this issue playing out here in Franklin County?
Well, I couldn't agree with Dr. Roberts more. It absolutely is perhaps the most important indicator of health of a community. When we think about infant mortality and the disparities that we continue to see, it's very troubling. That's the bad news. The good news is that we have groups like Celebrate One and all of our community partners who are working together to do our very best to reduce not only that disparity, but ultimately, reduce all infant mortality. But we have to focus in on that disparity. And we've seen other communities do that. I know we are working with Hamilton County and the city of Cincinnati. They've seen really good success there. But we have to call attention to that indicator as a priority for public health in Franklin County. Franklin County Public Health works very closely with Columbus Public Health and Celebrate One and all of our mm-hmm. community partners. So we see it as a high priority. It'll continue to be a high priority in our community health improvement plan. In fact, I was just at a meeting this morning about where we are with our current plan. And so, from a public health standpoint, really couldn't think of something more critical than making sure that we are reducing the infant mortality rate and closing that disparity gap.
We have less than a minute left, so I'm going to just make you, in 30 seconds, tell me what's next. So you develop this plan. You're required to develop a plan every few years. What do you do with it now?
Yes. So I mentioned I was at a meeting earlier this morning. So mm-hmm. what comes next is we will work with a whole group of organizations across our community to take the priority areas that have been identified in HealthMap 2025 and create a new community health improvement plan for our health department. Mm-hmm. And so, right now, we're 2 years into the current plan. This next iteration will be based on this health map, and it'll take us into 2027, 2028, when we'll do health map 2028. So it's all about assessment, planning, collective impact, working with partners, making sure we're in alignment with all of those stakeholders, and continuing to track our progress between assessments. And we have information on our website on how we're doing that.
We'll have it all solved by 2028, right? I'm sure. No. We've been talking with Franklin County Health Commissioner Joe Mazzola about the county's 2025 health map. Thank you for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
This has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.